Tail hitch your net worth with magic internet money.
Welcome to the Magic Internet Money Podcast. This is a special episode with my good friend Ivan Brightly, who's somebody that I've known in the space for years, like going back to like 2013-14, I think it is. Ivan's somebody that I like respect his opinion a lot because he brings a balanced, nuanced view to things, and he's also really technical, so he really gets the technology behind blockchain and Bitcoin, and has always been someone that I've trusted my private keys with. And there's not many people in the space that I would actually trust my private keys with. So anyway, with that, let me say I'm grateful for you guys for listening, and now let's get to the conversation. What I'm going to do,
Brad Mills is a partner at X Squared Ventures. All opinions expressed by Brad and his guests do not reflect the opinions of X Squared Ventures or X Squared Management. Investing in cryptocurrencies is high risk and you can get wrecked. Do not treat any opinion expressed on this show as investment advice, but only as an expression of Brad's opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Do not attempt to hodl without doing your research first. The world not the way it used to be.
No, no, no. Great to have you on, Ivan. Thanks for agreeing to do this.
Brad, you're admitting to being a fan of centralization because I'm a one-man show here.
Well, you were also a partner at Galaxy. That was a pretty huge thing. And
yeah, it was fun. It was good to go ahead and be early in the space and be part of a team of people that, you know, were willing to build a business when it was risky. It was risky doing it in the summer of 2017 to go ahead and build a company that, you know, first was going to be a hedge fund and then ultimately ended up turning into a publicly traded multi-divisional type of, you know, firm to provide, you know, any number of services. Basically, the Goldman Sachs was the attempt. Goldman Sachs of crypto was the goal. It was a good time. I really enjoyed my time at Galaxy. I left in January, and I don't regret, you know, being out and being on my own since.
Yeah, I mean, gives you more time to do like racing cars and doing all kinds of fun hobbies like that, right?
Well, COVID didn't help with that, but yes, in theory, it should.
So, you know, before Galaxy, which if people are listening to this, like entrepreneur friends of mine or family or whatever, Galaxy is like one of the kind of bigger brand companies in the space headed by Mike Novogratz, who used to run a hedge fund in Wall Street called, I think it was Fortress, right?
He was one of the four partners at Fortress and obviously killed it there. You know, that company had an amazing run, went public. They, I think, made four guys into multi-billionaires in one day. Fantastic story. And then, you know, there was a little bit of an implosion at the end. You know, the company traded way over probably anything that the public should have valued it at. And, you know, Mike went ahead and looked for the next thing to do. And he's got some interesting stories. You know, his background is super interesting. You know, everything from spending, you know, 9-day retreats trying to find himself, you know, at meditation or just punishing himself on back-to-back marathons in a desert. And Galaxy fits in right with his personality.
So Galaxy, it was like, yeah, like you said earlier, it was like kind of risky reputationally, but also I heard on on Ben Hunt's show, he rebooted his podcast and he had Not So Fast come on and talk about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. And he described Mike as like an awesome guy, but a raccoon. So that was his description of Novogratz. He was like a raccoon, as in he's just going to keep piling over more garbage cans and just try to get as much money as he possibly can. So that was the description. He's like, I love him. He's such a nice guy. He's really good-hearted person. I love him, but he's not in it for like the philosophical reasons of Bitcoin and censorship resistance and privacy and things like that. He's in it to make a lot of money. So that's kind of where a lot of it comes down to for early Bitcoiners and even folks like you who were into cryptocurrency super early and like for philosophical reasons, not just to make money. Do you think the sailorization or whatever of the Wall Street, you know, new investor class is actually going to have an effect on that early Bitcoin mentality? Or do you think the Bitcoiners are going to be able to continue to like push forward those cypherpunk values and privacy and all that stuff?
You know, that's actually a good question. And to give Mike his credit, I think that Mike is an investor and is his family office. I actually think he is super passionate about the amount of innovation that's happening in this space. I think it's a little bit different when he's CEO of a regulated firm. There's a number of things that he does that are regulated and he needs to be more buttoned up and can't do some of the things that he would like to do as just an individual. So I think that he actually does have a fair bit of passion for people who are willing to just go ahead and bend rules and just build stuff without worrying about what authorities think. I think that when he puts his CEO hat on, I think he's a little bit different, and he has to be. And in terms of, you know, Wall Street showing up, it's going to change the flavor a little bit in the sense that, you know, you're going to have people with influence, people with money who are going to have a particular view that they would like to see for Bitcoin. And it's a legitimate thing. Bitcoin is really for everybody that's involved in it. And while you can't force somebody else to go ahead and do what you want to do in Bitcoin, you certainly have your own particular vote, if you will. And, you know, that vote is a market-based one where you can choose to buy, you can choose to sell, you can choose to invest in various projects that you feel are working on things that further the direction that Bitcoin should go in. You can lobby authorities to go ahead and change rules and regulations, either against or in favor of Bitcoin's progress. Yeah, you know, they'll show up and they will change things. The concern, of course, is that you end up with this centralization and that maybe, you know, Saylor and a bunch of other venture capitalists and a bunch of other super wealthy people pile into Bitcoin and they end up sitting with $100 billion worth of coin, maybe sitting on two or three, you know, companies that centrally custody it because they're not willing to go custody it themselves. Maybe they don't run their own nodes. They don't, you know, they don't really use it in the same cypherpunk mechanism that many early Bitcoiners or many hardcore Bitcoiners do. And in a way, they're sort of delegating their authority out to, you know, Coinbase and other companies who custody it and do run the nodes. You know, the one thing is that they're heavily aligned with most Bitcoiners in the sense that they really do want to see government adoption. They want to see a price appreciation. I think that, you know, everybody does. The question is going to come when it comes down to, you know, say, for example, I don't know, a new BIP that introduces additional privacy, increases scalability, sacrificing some of the decentralization. Will they push for that to happen? Possibly. But we've seen the way that, you know, Bitcoin core contributors act and they really are not beholden to anybody. So I think that, you know, when we have the smartest people working on a particular project and the replacement, you know, people are not readily available, I think it would be very, very hard for them to really push people who write the software and really the people who run the nodes and hold their own keys to do anything that is not in their best interest.
That's a really good point, man. I've never heard anybody yet. I mean, this is an early debate. You know, we're a few months into the real Wall Street piling in event of Bitcoin. And it's been a debate amongst Bitcoiners that, well, we kind of do have to worry that the values are going to change. And you just laid out a really good argument for why the users and the developers could put up a fight because they can't be replaced.
And, you know, a number of them are wealthy enough by being early investors of Bitcoin. Those that are not, you know, there are companies or, you know, nonprofits that find ways to go ahead and compensate developers so that they don't have to go ahead and have a full-time job and only contribute on nights and weekends. It's not probably enough. And, you know, I heavily recommend that people, you know, contribute to places like, for example, Chaincode is a tremendous, you know, operation. And there's a number of other firms that are really contributing toward, like Blockstream and whatnot, who are obviously contributing toward ensuring that developers can work on the core parts of Bitcoin without having to worry about getting a day job.
Did you guys run a node at Galaxy?
We certainly did, but I wouldn't say that, you know, we were not, you know, running our own node with our own Bitcoin Core and a Ledger hooked up to it. Well, first of all, Ledger didn't even function with Bitcoin Core at the time. We used custodians like everybody else too, but, you know, we did try to hold our own keys where we could. We would use products, you know, that we'd invested in, like BitGo and Fireblocks. And BitGo and Fireblocks allow you to hold your own keys. You're not just outsourcing your custody to somebody else. So, yeah, we used infrastructure from, you know, from companies who were probably more capable and smarter than we are, in the sense that we were not a technology firm, we were a financial firm. But we did try to hold our own keys and not simply put everything on exchanges, because we recognize the risk as, you know, as having a duty to shareholders. When you put all of your eggs in, say, for example, one basket, then, you know, potentially you could end up, you know, looking very silly later if there's some kind of a loss.
You know, in Bitcoin, the typical reason why early Bitcoiners get in is because they're trying to protect against not only deflation or devaluing of the dollar, but also seizure of money if there ever was a huge event like a 6102, a new executive order that said owning gold and Bitcoin and anything was illegal and you had to pay a 70% tax on it, like in a windfall tax or something like that. And a lot of Bitcoiners and people that are escaping capital controls globally turn to Bitcoin because it is, you can hold your own keys and there is no way that they can take it from you unless they go through like the legal system or boot your door down with the police or whatever. But if millions and millions of people are holding their own keys, it becomes really hard to enforce that sort of a 6102. Did you guys ever talk about that? Was that ever like something you guys thought about at Galaxy? Like the risk of government seizure of the coins? Was that anything that was ever on your radar?
I don't think that that was a big concern. The big concern would be that you just have regulatory action that would make it either, you know, hard to trade, that the liquidity would get worse, that potentially, I mean, that you could always have, you know, some number of lawmakers who decide that, you know, Bitcoin is just bad, bad for the sovereign ability for, you know, a country to go ahead and operate. And there was at least, you know, at least one very prominent congressman who went ahead and Brad Sherman, who would, if it had been up to him, just flat out banned Bitcoin if it was up to him. We had a small degree of concern that you'd have some kind of a rising chorus of lawmakers who or regulators who would decide that a ban was in the works. And of course, that would have been, you know, a problem. Problem for running a company, probably long-term, you know, adoption of Bitcoin, it probably doesn't change anything, but it certainly could push out the curve and it can make it, you know, challenging. It's tough when you try and tell, you know, a million people who hold Bitcoin that they get to choose. They get to be criminals or they get to go ahead and, you know, decide to go back to their normal way of life and ignore Bitcoin, you know, and a lot of people would give up. Not enough, but I think some people really would. I think the things people were always worried about was it was more regulatory actions. It was more that, you know, that you might get caught, you know, trading something that you felt was a cryptocurrency and the community felt was a cryptocurrency. And it turns out that the SEC disagrees. And, it, you know, potentially they could have said something like Ethereum was a security. They could have said, you know, any number of other assets were a security. You could even make the argument that Bitcoin is a security. I don't think it stands up very well. But as a regulator, you could choose to do it. And then all of a sudden you need licenses and rules to go ahead and hold it. There's no ability to hold your own shares. And it's just a giant mess. You know, look at what's happened to Ripple.
Yeah, so like Ripple is a perfect example there. Do you think that the institutions right now that are listing Ripple, allowing Ripple to be traded, like obviously we're seeing a bunch of them delist Ripple. Do you think any of these guys are kind of like clenching their butt cheeks thinking, oh shit, like I just had an illegal security listed on my platform for a while. What do you think the SEC does going forward now that they're going after Ripple? Do you think they're going to take retroactive penalties against funds and exchanges and stuff? Or are they just going to kind of like go out from here forward, you got to be a good actor?
I'll start off with saying I'm definitely not a lawyer. I'm not sure exactly what the SEC is going to do. It seems so far that the focus of the SEC is primarily with the main issuers, the main deciders. They have not gone after too many of the people who might have been considered to be promoters, unless you were very specifically a Paris Hilton promoter, where you went ahead and, you know, and got compensated for going ahead and advising people to go buy something, which probably was a securities offering. I don't think that a tremendous number of other firms are going to get caught up in this. Potentially, they could be a fine. There could be some kind of a situation where the SEC says that, you know what, Coinbase and other firms that enabled trading with XRP that you should have known better and that you enabled the trading of unregistered security and that there is a, you know, some kind of a fine that or an action that needs to happen. I think they could do that. I think that the SEC may say that, look, you made your best faith effort. And that as soon as you were made aware that this thing was a security, you delisted it, and that might be good enough. As far as Ripple goes, I don't know. I think that they're done. I think it's over. I've got some friends there too, you know, so I don't think that they're bad guys, but I do think that if you look at, you know, the leadership, the management, I think that clearly they're going to have to go ahead and settle, is my guess. I don't see any situation where they get to fight this one out in court and win.
And what about like, because before Galaxy, you were one of the guys trying to push forward the Bitcoin ETF, the Solidex Bitcoin ETF, which maybe people don't know if they're just coming in after like 2018 or something like that. They don't know the whole history of like the ETF was trying to get started and everybody was cheering and rooting for the ETF. But what ended up happening there? Can you kind of like run people through the like what you guys were trying to do with the ETF and then why you guys stopped?
We didn't so much get stopped. We went ahead and pushed as hard as we possibly could. And we put together the best product we'd come up with. And, you know, we know what the SEC came back with. ETFs have been a long time in the game. And some of them, you know, prior to, let's say, Bitcoin, some of them have gotten a lot of resistance. JP Morgan had a copper ETF that I'll get the dates wrong. But let's say in the mid 2000s, they started up with this idea that you're going to have copper ETF to trade copper. And there was actually a fair bit of pushback from the copper industry who said that, well, you're going to hurt us because we use copper to go ahead and, you know, do plumbing and any other number of things in the industry. The introduction of a copper ETF is going to push the price up and it's going to go ahead and cause us harm. When JP Morgan filed for this, they went ahead and filed objections and with the SEC and said that, you know, you can't do this. It's going to harm our industry, blah, blah, blah. And it took a few years for it to go, you know, through. Ultimately, it did get approved, but there are situations where, you know, you file for an ETF, you know, which is a relatively standard product, but didn't even exist in the late 1990s, and you get denied because of any number of reasons. In this case, it was because of industry pushing back against it. So 2013, you know, the Winklevoss filed for their ETF. We looked at it, and it wasn't something that we thought of at Solidex when we first put together the company in 2014. We decided to go down an easier route of offering swaps, which really didn't need any type of regulatory approval. There were some regulatory filing requirements, and we did abide by those, but there wasn't any type of, you know, situation where we could be denied for offering the product because it was all institutional investors. You know, there's no retail. And, you know, we offered it in 2014 with a bear market. We were hoping that, you know, people would want to short it just as much as they wanted to go long. And in a bear market, institutions who didn't even know what Bitcoin was were probably scared to go ahead and do anything with it, probably because they had no particular views one way or the other, long, short, or indifferent. That was a little too early. And then in 2015, we finally decided that, look, you know, we could put together a better product than had been offered so far. We put together our offering, confidentially filed at the end of 2015. And throughout 2016, you know, we worked on putting together the best service providers we could find with, you know, Bank of New York, Mellon as the bank, as the cash custodian, and, you know, other firms that were really solid to put together a good, decent product. And we had some good meetings with the SEC. They definitely were interested.
Really?
In the sense that when the SEC met with us, they definitely brought the full divisional departments, you know, sometimes 30, 40, 50 people in a call. To give them their credit, they did put in time and effort. And then when it came down to, you know, the actual approval
process. What would you guys say, like, during those calls? Was it just you and David and someone else? Like, who was in those calls with you?
Well, Dan Galassi was CEO for Solidex, and he definitely, you know, ran a lot with the show. We also had my colleague Dimitri, who is, you know, a former attorney who did a lot of the pitches. And so those two were the ones who actually showed up in Washington to go ahead and pitch the SEC. We had a number of other calls. We had our attorneys in the calls, and we also, you know, brought with us some of the service providers. And the service providers were amazing. You know, they definitely, you know, went over their skis and said that they would offer things, you know, if the SEC needed it, you know, to happen. Probably promises they might not have even been able to keep up, but, you know, they certainly put, you know, forth the best effort I could imagine. As things moved up the approval chain, there were just some people who were not comfortable with this, clearly didn't want this to happen, and they just denied it. They denied the Winklevoss in, I believe it was March of 2017, and we got our full denial 3 weeks later. But you know, I remember it was a Friday afternoon. The SEC loves to go ahead and shove things out about 4 or 5 o'clock, you know, right before the weekend. And they completely destroyed my weekend with knowing that there was no chance whatsoever that we were going to get approved in 3 weeks' time. We read through it with a fine-tooth comb and just, you know, kind of went out, had a drink, and then went home and and kind of regrouped for thinking about what we do next.
What did you guys think? Like, were you guys thinking, like, this is just, like, too much? We can't keep trying to wait for the SEC to catch up to this thing. We're just going to buy Bitcoin and just personally benefit.
I can say that I definitely thought that way. But, you know, look, my partners there were pretty tough. They made some pretty good partners with other firms such as Van Eck. And look, I think that, you know, full credit, I think, is due for Dan Galassi, Solidex, and other people like myself at Solidex for Van Eck being this interested in Bitcoin today. And they're still pushing forward. They still have, you know, a filing in the works that, you know, that they relaunched again once more into the breach, you know, was the quote I think I saw on Twitter. And good for them, because if you don't have a filing in the works, then, you know, then you can't be in line to get approved. And at some point, whether or not it's going to be this year or 5 years from now or 10, some point the SEC is absolutely going to approve it. The key requirement that has to happen right now is Jay Clayton has to be gone. Jay Clayton has now resigned.
Why is that? Did he have some kind of personal vendetta against Bitcoin or something?
Well, look, you know, think about this from the perspective of somebody who is a career attorney and who is in charge of the SEC. And think about where Bitcoin fits in with, you know, the SEC's goals. And, you know, they're concerned with investor fraud. They're concerned with market manipulation. They're concerned with systemic risk. And Bitcoin is like this tiny pimple, you know, that they have to deal with. The amount of time that it takes them to deal with Bitcoin and other ICO type of, you know, operations is enormous. But the amount of impact on the American economy is tiny. So, you know, automatically on a effort versus, you know, like reward basis, it's a bad thing to get involved with. And then there's the fact that, let's say that the SEC had approved a Bitcoin ETF and they did it, you know, December 2017, you know, and people had piled in at 10, 15, 19 grand, maybe pushed it to 30, you know, ETF or no, we were going to get a bear market at some point. We're going to get a turn of the cycle and you were going to get an 80% plunge. Maybe you got a 90% plunge because of an ETF. Forgetting any type of technical flaws with Bitcoin or something like that, you could have been the chairman who went ahead and approved a rush of $5 billion into an ETF in the course of a month, only to have investors right. decimated by 50 to 80% over the next like month or, you know, or 6 months. Does that sound like a good, you know, career decision?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, if you're the SEC and that's your mandate to try to protect Americans from losing money, but, you know, obviously we both agree on the...
If you're not a conservative lawyer type, then it's fine. But if you're a conservative lawyer type and you see your future after this is that, hey, look, maybe you want to go ahead and either go back into private practice and earn, you know, double digit millions per year. Fine. That's an option. Or maybe you think that you want to go climb the rungs. And maybe you think that, you know, Treasury Secretary or some other type of cabinet position is in the realm for you. Or maybe you want to run for government. Who knows? Who knows what you want to do? But whatever you want to do, Bitcoin doesn't get you there. Only thing Bitcoin right. does is goes ahead and gets you to be the guy who went ahead and helped screw over, you know, a whole bunch of investors potentially. And when the market turns against them now. And then on top of that,
they're just weighing the risk of Bitcoin crashing and their career being ended.
Yeah.
Versus the benefit to people of getting into Bitcoin early and getting huge gains in their regulated accounts.
I mean, if I was Jay Clayton's personal advisor, I'd tell him not to do it.
But you tell him to buy Bitcoin, though, right?
He definitely should buy Bitcoin, no question. But, you know, Hester Pierce, for example, on the other hand, is very, very different. And she recognizes the SEC is...
And Giancarlo, too.
Well, Giancarlo is a little bit different role in the sense the CFTC, they don't worry about retail because retail can't really buy futures and options, or they can, but you got to be a pretty sophisticated individual to go ahead and trade those things. So Giancarlo has a little bit of an easier role. But for Hester Pierce's, you know, to give her some credit, she recognizes the SEC has a real job to do. And their goal is not to go ahead and stop people from losing money. It is to stop people from going ahead and lying to them. The industry is all about disclosures. Did you go ahead and inform people that, hey, there were insiders who were selling at the company when they were talking about how awesome their stock was? You know, those type of things are the things the SEC pays attention to. And I think that's the focus for Hester. She looked at it and she said, you know, it's risky, but that's okay because you're telling investors it's risky. And why would the SEC get in the way of blocking investors from investing in things they wish to do?
Why do you think it's important that we have an ETF when we have things like Grayscale and 3iQ and these other, well, I guess 3iQ's the only regulated one, right? Or is there other regulated
ones?
You know,
I haven't paid attention to the 3iQ product super closely because I don't trade Canadian markets all that often.
You're missing out on all the beaver stocks.
Yes. Well, that's true. That's true.
All the syrup stocks, well, and the scam gold mine companies.
I could just buy Bitcoin to hold my own keys, so I'm good.
Yeah.
To cover that a little bit, the main reason why is friction. So if you take your average investor, you know, they've got a 401k or they've got a regular brokerage account, you know, with one of the discount brokers, Fidelity or Schwab or E-Trade or whatnot. They could open up a Coinbase account. They could go ahead and you'll go with Square or something like that. But if they really want to invest a significant amount of money, either they're doing it on their own or they're doing it, you know, with the advice of their registered investment advisor, their, you know, basically their broker. And it's just so much easier if they can go ahead and just put in a 1%, 2%, you know, position in BTC or ETH or any of these other things by just simply buying it right in the markets. And the only thing you can do that today easily with, you know, if you're a Canadian or if you want to trade foreign markets, you can go ahead and buy the 3iQ product. In Europe, you've got CoinShares products. And in the U.S., the primary one, the largest one is, of course, GBTC, Grayscale's product. And Grayscale, it's a great product. Barry's brilliant for having pushed so hard to go ahead and make this happen when in 2013, it looked like it was going to be a very tiny market and he didn't care. He just pushed forward with it. I don't know that he planned it in any way to go ahead and have this type of, you know, net result at a premium for institutional investors who go ahead and are able to, you know, buy into the private placement, sell it, as the public shares once it's been seasoned for 6 months now.
So let's describe that process for the average person who's listening to this that does not even understand that, because it is important and it's really visible in like the Litecoin one and the Bitcoin Cash one and the Ethereum one. Not so much in Bitcoin anymore. The premium's kind of gone down, but can you describe it in layman's terms, like what that strategy is that these institutional or accredited investors, like the rich people, are doing with the Grayscale product to make money through arbitraging the whole thing?
Sure. The best way I've heard described, you know, for Grayscale's GBTC is that it's a side door ETF. And it really is one in the sense that you're if you're buying as a professional investor, if you're investing into the private placement, you buy, let's say, $100 worth of shares, and you get a price placed.
Well, they wouldn't be buying $100. No. Right? They'd be buying like $1 million
well,
or something.
Well, actually, you can little. I think it's their limits are like $25,000 or $50,000. So it's not an enormous amount, but you do have to be an accredited investor, no question.
So accredited investor is like somebody that's a millionaire, basically, right? Or they're making like $200K a year or something like that.
Yeah, it's pretty high bar. You either have to have $1 million in assets, or you have to be making $200,000 or $300,000 a year per year for the last 3 years. It's significant. But the investment amount doesn't have to be $1 million. So let's say that you bought $100,000 worth of Grayscale Bitcoin Investment Trust shares. You get the NAV price, basically the price of Bitcoin on the next business day at 4 o'clock is whatever price you get. So you're not paying some kind of a huge premium. You're paying whatever the market is on that day. Originally, when you first invested in 2013, if you were an early investor, you got to pay, you know, a Grayscale, a 2.5% annual fee, and there was no easy mechanism for how you would possibly get out. There was no real redemption. They briefly had their own redemptions, but the SEC went ahead and dinged them for that and told them they couldn't do it anymore. So that was it. You were in. And then eventually they created a reverse shell merger, where basically Grayscale bought a company, reverse merger, and then went ahead and listed the trust shares as GBTC on the OTC QX markets, which is basically, it's a variation of pick sheets is what it is.
That was what, 2015, 16? Or
I think 2015 is when they first listed it. I'd have to go back and check. I'm not 100% sure.
So that was like a way for the people who invested Bitcoin into the trust, into the private placement?
Either Bitcoin or cash into the private placement.
What's that called when you put the Bitcoin in? Or
In kind.
So you can invest in kind or with dollars, and then you get the price of Bitcoin the next business day. Or if you invested Bitcoin directly, like gave them your private keys or sent them your UTXOs, you just got the price of Bitcoin the next day as well, like in fiat terms? Or
there was going to be basically a NAV, which is basically a certain amount of Bitcoin per share, and you got whatever the price was for whatever Bitcoin was trading that day. You got a certain number of shares that you had denominated. As a private investor, as an accredited investor, you were pretty well covered. And then it happened to be that, you know, as it was listed on the OTCQX markets and as more people were able to go ahead and buy it in their regular brokerage accounts, there were definitely some brokerages. Like if you initially in 2015, if you went ahead and probably talked to, you know, Citi Private Wealth or Goldman Sachs, they'd probably tell you, no, you couldn't buy this thing because they don't like dealing with pink sheet type of stocks. But many brokerages allowed for it, you know, and by now, if you're blocking it, I think you're going to lose clients, and it has been probably the case for several years now. If you told your high net worth clients that you can't buy this product, you know, there's a lot of friction at that point.
GBTC is a closed end fund, they call it, right? So
it
there's
is.
Only those private placements, what, every 6 months or something like that?
It's open except for when it's not. And it's only closed at times that are denominated by the SEC for Rule 144A, which is all about private placements, about, you know, when they're allowed to go ahead and sell, and, you know, all the rest of that. Without getting into details, it's open most of the time, except for when by rules and regulations, it can't be. It has to be closed during certain financial reporting activity.
Okay, so if somebody came to them tomorrow with like $1 billion, right, like a family office or something like that, or the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund or something, and they're like, we want to put $1 billion into the private placement, the next private placement, would they just open up one for them, or do they have to wait until like a couple months? Or
it is an SEC reporting OTC traded stock, and so they definitely have rules and regulations about when they can go ahead and accept new investors. If it was open, Barry would happily take that $1 billion, and, you know, honestly, at that point, kind of. Those kind of money, Grayscale would work very closely with them to make sure they're not moving the markets and figure out a way to get them invested, no question. Probably take a week or two to go ahead and get $1 billion done.
I mean, and these are kind of real numbers we're talking about now, because they're up to like $20 billion under management in Bitcoin now, right?
Yes.
There's significant money coming in through this, you know, money that's already in the stock market, trying to get exposure to the Bitcoin price from these institutional investors and high net worth people, these millionaires and billionaires and stuff. I'm just trying to paint the picture for not just me, but people like me that don't kind of get everything you're saying, but kind of follow. So there's two things here. There's like the Galaxy private placement, which is like you can invest dollars or Bitcoin in kind into the private placement, which is not actually traded on the stock market. But then they created that second vehicle you talked about, which was like a pink sheet at the time, which was the GBTC vehicle. What is that? So is that like a linked one-to-one to the private placement? Or like, how is that relationship with the GBTC and the private placement? How does that work?
They're actually one and the same. The difference is that if you're a private placement investor, your shares are restricted. So you hold the same shares as somebody as GBTC, but your shares are restricted for a 6-month seasoning period where you cannot sell them.
Yummy.
More yummy once they're seasoned, for sure. Once that those restrictions are removed, then yes, you can go ahead and sell them.
So it is the same thing. It's just like a different class of shares that you can't sell for 6 months.
It's even the exact same shares. It's just that they're restricted. You can't transfer or sell them. It's the same stock. It's just, as far as I know, once they're unrestricted, you can sell them on the public markets. And the problem is that there is that gap. There's that 6 month. Originally, it was a 12-month window. They became an SEC reporting company. Now it's a 6-month window. You know, but at the end of the day, that 6-month gap is a long time. So that if you, if you as a investor, you see that, hey, look, there's a 20% premium difference between the underlying NAV, the amount of Bitcoin that is held by the Grayscale Trust and the price that GBTC is trading at, you can ARB this difference. The difference is you have to go ahead and buy the shares, wait 6 months, and then you can ARB it. With an ETF, you would have something called an authorized participant, and they would be able to do that every day, all day long. You can do it every second of the day if you want to. You instantly go ahead and create new shares by, let's say you would give Grayscale one, Bitcoin. They would instantly create you one Bitcoin's worth of shares. You would instantly go ahead and sell those in the market, and you would be able to go ahead and collapse this premium, or be able to go ahead and buy at discounts and be able to go ahead and make profits on that. And that arbitrage difference is what makes an ETF super functional and what makes them track the underlying. And that's the big reason why the SEC at this point should approve it. And I think that that's going to be the big pressure on them, is they're now allowing for retail to go ahead and to buy Bitcoin, at least exposure, but have to pay this enormous premium because they haven't chosen to approve the proper vehicles, which is an ETF, which will track the underlying.
That ETF, like if that billionaire comes in and says, I want to put $1 billion into the ETF, they don't have to wait any period of time. It's just like they buy the ETF, then the ETF company goes and buys Bitcoin, and now they have one-to-one backing, theoretically, because the market's supposed to be efficient. Say if the price of Bitcoin is 30,000, and then buying that Bitcoin makes the share value of the ETF shares be worth $31,000 worth of Bitcoin. Well, someone's going to like short that, right, to get it down to 30,000. So it stays one-to-one, as close to one-to-one paired with the price of Bitcoin and the NAV, which is the net asset value or the book value of the assets that they're holding. In Grayscale, it can go up as much as like a 10x higher than the actual NAV value, which happened with Ethereum earlier in the year. I remember we were talking about that, and I was just mind boggled by how huge the premium was for people. So they did it with Bitcoin, and there was a 20% premium or whatever, and there's that incentive for a fund or a wealthy person to just an accredited investor to put Bitcoin into the trust, wait that seasoning period, which was 12 months, but now 6, and then hope that by the time that seasoning period is done, the price is higher and the premium is still there. And you're actually made 20% just for nothing, just to sell your shares onto the market in your 401k or your Roth IRA or whatever. So it's even tax-free and tax-deferred. So that was a pretty cool strategy for accredited investors for a while. But then the Ethereum Trust launched, and it was like $80 or something like that was the trading price of the Grayscale GETH or whatever it's called, the pink sheet version or whatever.
ETHE.
But you could put ETH into the trust, and people just didn't realize it was actually only about $8 worth of Ethereum that was backing the net asset value, but the price of Ethereum at the time was like $100. So people actually, I think, got fooled into thinking that ETHE was like a discount. I think they thought that they were getting like free Ethereum, but they're actually paying over like 10x for the Ethereum. I was kind of taken aback by that when I saw that. I'm like, why does Grayscale allow something like that to happen? Can't they step in and say like, well, they ended up doing a split, I think, right? Like it seems like the premium has come down, but like, what's it like now?
There's nothing Grayscale can do about it except for disclose. And they do have on their website, you can prominently go ahead and look at their NAV. You can look at the amount of ETH or Litecoin or Bitcoin that is held per share. And so any investor that wants to spend 3 minutes of due diligence could quickly figure out what they're actually getting. Some of them clearly probably don't. And some of them are also, they're aware of it and they just feel that, hey, look, the price appreciation for Bitcoin is so great, or Ethereum or whatnot, that it's worth it now. And I've been on the retail investor who has held GBTC in a brokerage account or in a 401k, and I've paid the premium. It's something where I was willing to pay a premium because I felt that Bitcoin would probably, you know, way, way outperform that. And under, you know, like, let's call it a 20% premium, that feels reasonable. You know, as long as you think that Bitcoin is likely to do a 50% in the next 12 to, you know, 24 months, paying a 20% premium that might evaporate away seems reasonable. Paying a 900% premium on ETH, you're playing a greater fool theory, or you are the fool at that point.
I think they just didn't realize, most people didn't realize, that we're buying the trust, not putting into the private placement, because they're realizing there's a huge arbitrage here. I can roll the dice, because honestly, it was a risk, because you have to wait that 6 month period. And in that time, something could change, regulations could change, the price could collapse, and you could actually be down on your bet. So there is some risk there. But I think the retail people and even the whoever's buying that ETH didn't realize how crazy high of a premium it was. Do you know what it is now? Must be down to like 50% at least.
Oh, it's even less.
Something more.
When I checked it yesterday, okay, it was something like around 16-17% for ETH.
So that's reasonable.
I mean, like, look, you know, again, like, this is not financial advice. You do your own diligence. But it's the type of thing where yeah, I would personally pay a 16-17% premium if I felt that the price appreciation in the coming months was worth it.
Not a 600% premium.
You know,
600% is a little much.
Look, hats off to the person who went ahead and saw it at a 500% premium and traded it all the way up to a 1,000% premium. So good for them. But that's not me. That's too risky for me. So, you know, I wouldn't have touched that.
Back to the point of like why an ETF is needed. It's not really needed. If Bitcoiners have proven that the ETF wasn't needed, because all of the ETF companies that got denied, it seems like what had happened when we were following it back in the day was like all the people that were just waiting for the ETF just decided to buy Bitcoin instead of going in through the ETF, or at least they tried to.
An ETF isn't required. If you go back to the 1990s, there were no ETFs, and finance functioned for, you know, hundreds of years prior to that. So clearly you don't need them, but it's a matter of efficiency. If people want exposure to things like metals or Bitcoin or other assets, you know, the composite of the S&P 500, without needing to go ahead and, you know, get into complicated futures or options trading, then an ETF makes sense. And so from an efficiency standpoint, you want to see one. It's the same thing as saying that, hey, look, technically you don't need Coinbase. Technically, and we don't need any of these on-ramps, you know, everybody can just go ahead and talk to each other and, you know, buy $100 worth of Bitcoin from their buddy who mined it, you know, at home. Yeah, you can do that. It's not very efficient. So an ETF just makes the friction go away. And yes, if we never got an ETF in the next 10 years, I think Bitcoin would do just fine. I do think that more retail investors would be harmed by paying the premium for these products like GBTC, or paying, you know, premiums potentially for buying, you know, on some of the retail products like, you know, Square or Coinbase. But, you know, look, at least that's a market driven decision. They should be able to educate themselves, become aware of that, and decide what they want to do. An ETF just gives them another better option for getting exposure to their regular brokerage accounts.
When you're talking to your like regular friends and family, do you recommend that they take advantage of the GBTC stuff or the like the QBTC, like in Canada? Like, would you think people should put some in their retirement accounts that are tax optimized or tax deferred or whatever? Like, what percentages do you usually give people for advice for hold this amount of real Bitcoin or with a custodian, or what's your general like advice for somebody that's coming to you now in this bull market and being like, hey, I haven't heard you're into Bitcoin. How do I get some? What do I do?
I sort of hate being a financial advisor for people, because whatever you tell them, you know, yes, you might make the money, but you're also going to go ahead and get them to have, you know, their own losses. So I try not to tell people really what to do with their funds, but I do try to help them with what their options are. And if you're somebody who's not an accredited investor, do I think GBTC is appropriate? For sure. You know, there's nothing wrong with it. If you're not willing to move money out of a brokerage account, if you want to take up a 1 or 2% position in BTC, you want to get price exposure and you don't want to be left behind. Yeah, I feel the GBTC is perfectly reasonable, especially in a 401k account where it's somebody who can tolerate a, let's call it a 5%, you know, total loss, you know, for GBTC, because, you know, the price of Bitcoin goes to zero or nearly zero. Fine. Not a big deal. But I will tell most people that, hey, look, you have plenty of other options. You know, you can easily go ahead and open up a Coinbase account. You know, you can just custody with Coinbase if you're smart about it. If you're willing to take the plunge and you know, custody your own assets. And quite frankly, for people who are brand new, I tell them for the most part to go ahead and buy $100 worth of Bitcoin or something that they would be willing to go ahead and blow on a night of drinking, you know, with their buddies or a night out in Vegas. Just buy some Bitcoin or buy whatever you want to. If you want to buy something else on Coinbase, go ahead and buy that too. Hopefully you research it afterwards because you'll, you know, that'll help you motivate you to go ahead and read the differences between Litecoin and Bitcoin or something else like that. But I just tell people to go ahead and buy something like that. And if you want to withdraw $100 worth of Bitcoin or $10 worth of Bitcoin, you know, fees might be a little bit higher for that, but to your own wallet software with no ledger, no hardware wallet, and you want to play around your computer, fine. You know, it's just like, you know, $10 in a regular leather wallet. And there's no reason why people should be afraid of losing some, you know, small amount of money like that. It's when you want to start investing life-changing amounts of money that, you know, you wouldn't easily be able to replace it. That's where I think that, you know, people should be really smart about things. And if you're going to hold it all in Coinbase, at least heavily secure your email, figure out how two-factor authentication works, you know, recognize that, you know, secured by AT&T or Verizon is not the same as, you know, secured by one-time passwords or whatnot. There's some work people have to do. It's not a lot, but they have to do some.
Do you like run your own node? Do you recommend people mess with that too? Or do you typically just hold that for like your really technically inclined friends?
If somebody's not a technical person and they have no interest in becoming their own bank or running their own node, then I don't try and push that any more than I try and push, you know, say, for example, somebody to, you know, learn how DNA splicing works just because they should.
Get a CRISPR. Do some research, create a mutant fish, put it in the lake, just a small fish, just a small mutant, genetic mutated fish.
What could go wrong? I don't push people in that direction unless they're interested. If they really want to learn how a Bitcoin transaction works, then absolutely. You know, you can run Bitcoin node pruned on a laptop. You can run, you know, a Electrum. You can run, you know, a flurry of other, you know, software to go ahead and play around with it, get used to seeing what a real transaction is. I think in particular, the people who are real skeptics, I think those are the people who should do it. People who just want, you know, who are going to spend like 5 minutes thinking about Bitcoin in a week and aren't going to go ahead and spend the time and effort to go ahead and write down their own seed words and get a, you know, a stamp steal like piece and another backup stamp steal piece and then figure out, you know, tell their wife how they're going to go ahead and recover all of their wealth if they go ahead and leave. There are tons of people who are just not willing to put the time and effort into that. And for those people, quite frankly, Robinhood or other investment opportunities where you can't withdraw the funds are probably the best choice. People have to be motivated enough to go ahead and bother to take the next step and actually withdraw their funds to their own keys.
I always shit on Coinbase on this podcast. Like and you know this about me, like we've been friends for so long that you know I'm always shitting on Coinbase and these companies that don't really like align with the ethos of Bitcoin and kind of, I feel like, work against Bitcoin in some ways. But I've also appreciated your take on Coinbase's role in making it accessible for people that don't want to look at Bitcoin or something because of the magic internet money, sort of like Mt. Gox style PHP, one guy running a PHP server setup. And I've said it before on the podcast a couple of times, like, oh, my friend Ivan has a good take on it. So maybe you can give your take on why you think Coinbase is good as the steel man for my straw man.
I'd start off by saying that, like, first of all, like, if this is a libertarian dream, who are you to tell Coinbase what to do? They're a private company.
Soon to be public, though.
Potentially soon to be public. Yeah, that thing should happen this year. I would say that Coinbase, they're ex-Goldman Sachs guys. They were early in the space, 2012, to go put together the company, and as were a number of other early exchanges. And the one thing that they have done is they've gone ahead and they've wrapped Bitcoin in a way that is tolerable and understandable for the vast majority of Wall Street, regulators, lawmakers, that type of thing. They abide by the rules and regulations, you know, for the most part. They try very hard to get money services business licenses. They spent the time and effort to go ahead and sit down with regulators to go ahead and have, you know, any type of surveillance necessary on transactions to appease the banks that they have to work with. And so because of that, you know, they're willing to go ahead and take a lot of shots from regulators such as the SEC, such as FinCEN, such as, you know, the IRS. That's a tremendous amount of effort for a company to go ahead and employ all of the people necessary to go ahead and put together those programs, put together the compliance required to make that stuff viable. And without that, you know, I think that, you know, it'd be pretty easy to see that the liquidity would be lower, the prices we benefit from today would be lower. And you wouldn't be able to have these companies that you could point toward that have, you know, several hundred people, maybe 1,000 people working for them that are real jobs that are created out of building infrastructure that is primarily centered around Bitcoin and maybe other assets in the space, but, you know, got started, no question, with Bitcoin. So I think that Coinbase is, you know, is a critical element to making the adoption smoother than it would be otherwise. Otherwise, it's a bunch of libertarians who are, you know, on the one hand saying that Bitcoin is great, but they're also telling, you know, the federal government that the, you know, you have to end the Fed too at the same time. That message is just going to fall on deaf ears. Because, you know, clearly, if you're somebody who wants to burn it all down, you're not going to be able to go ahead and convince, you know, the people who are on the inside that they should change anything at all.
I like the point that you made about, like, Coinbase being a way for somebody who's not, like, a libertarian or an anarchist or something like that. Somebody who's just, like, a normal person with mainstream philosophical and political views that hasn't gone down the rabbit hole and even doesn't even know what money is. They just heard about Bitcoin. And they're like, I want to get some. I'll Google it. I go to Coinbase.com, set up an account. And it's a professional sort of like operation. It's a Silicon Valley, move fast, break things, huge company that is building good software and secure software. So it does help professionalize Bitcoin in the eyes of the mainstream person. Now, the Bitcoiners like me will always be like, come from the perspective of like, they used to be pro-Bitcoin, but now because they support all the things that compete with Bitcoin and they invest in all these things, like actually with Coinbase Ventures and Andreessen Horowitz has the huge crypto fund that they raised $400 million or something for. And these guys are pushing noobs into like, learn about how 0x works and get some Stellar. And like, they're pushing people towards all these other assets. So we look at it like, people are Googling, how do I buy Bitcoin? And then Coinbase is converting them into altcoin investors and casino, like the crypto casino. So it's tough to balance for a Bitcoiner the like benefits of that valid point about, yeah, they're a way for the average mainstream person to get access to Bitcoin with like, they just recently started supporting Bitcoin and, you know, the whole SegWit2x thing is maybe another debate, but they definitely have some kind of negative adoption, you know, to Bitcoin. They have some kind of factor that contribute to people getting wrecked on altcoins and becoming like crypto casino gamblers. And they did that thing where they acquired Hacking Team and like, you know, they surveil people and they work with the government. So I think that if Coinbase didn't exist, then that traffic would all go to like other more pro Bitcoin companies that have supported Bitcoin, that support Lightning Network. And it's just like been a really genius way for Coinbase to get the number, like a high search rank and just suck in all these customers that are Googling Bitcoin. Cause everybody's Googling for how do I buy Bitcoin? They're not looking like, how do I buy name your coin? They're looking, how do I buy Bitcoin? And then they come to Coinbase and all the other exchanges and get sold altcoins. So that's where I get frustrated with Coinbase.
On the one hand, like I recognize there are some things people don't like about Coinbase. But on the other hand, I find it very hard to be sympathetic to people who really say that they believe in free markets and that they believe in libertarian approaches toward, you know, toward running their lives. And that somehow that, you know, Coinbase should just offer Bitcoin and USD and that's it. First of all, it wouldn't be in the best interest of Coinbase shareholders or in Coinbase itself. And secondly, it feels like, well, you offered too much as a complaint. I don't know. I can't buy into that at all. You know, offering Litecoin, you know, or any other number of assets that, you know, I would agree are probably inferior to Bitcoin is just delivering a market. The customer wants it. The markets clearly, you know, support it. Liquidity wouldn't be there. Coinbase isn't twisting somebody's arm to go ahead and make them buy Litecoin. They could choose to buy Bitcoin if they wanted to. It's right there. Still, some people choose to go ahead and either trade or they want to buy something they think is a cheaper Bitcoin or whatever it might be. I mean, if you really want to go ahead and ding exchanges for offering other assets, part of the problem is unit bias. You know, it's that people look at Bitcoin and they say, oh, it's $30,000. I'll never be able to buy one. What is this thing? Oh, this thing is trading for 50 cents. I can buy 100 of them. Oh, let's go with that. Bitcoin went with, you know, 30,000 and this could go to at least 100 bucks. You know, it's not smart. It's not sophisticated. It's not, you know, solid analysis. It doesn't pass rigor, and yet it's a human element. And so if you really want to go ahead and fix that particular problem, you know, I guess go to Satoshi's and push on that, push on changing the denomination. And many people have this good idea. It's just that it's very hard. It's inertia. Bitcoin is here to stay. And it's very hard to go ahead and go to Millibits or Satoshis or whatever you're going to go.
I think that would be a good idea, man. We'll somebody's got to start a lobbying group that goes and tries to corral all the exchanges and wallets and get them to switch to Bits or Sats or something. It's time, you know, like Bitcoin's going to 100K probably in the next year, at least maybe 2 years, whatever it is. It's going up if, you know, things continue the way they are. So that's going to be hard, like to go for the average person to buy $1,000 worth of Bitcoin. And it says you're getting 0.001 of something like that. That's not, that doesn't feel very good.
No, it really doesn't. You know, people have tried it. There have been various wallets for a while. It used to be called Bread. Now it's BRD. Bread wallet by default. It only showed, I think, millibits, and you couldn't change it to Bitcoin. They put their foot down and that was it. It was millibits or nothing.
Cash App just switched, I think.
Yeah, and millibits by default and whatnot. And then eventually they gave up. And I think by now, I think it went back to Bitcoin because they're, you know, people got too confused. There, it just wasn't, you know, it wasn't enough groundswell to make it happen. So if you want to go ahead and be the CEO of millibits or Satoshis, go for it. You know, the Satoshi movement, you can go ahead and do it. I think that I would sooner push for people to go ahead and, I don't know why humankind has decided that there should be no commas to the right side of the decimal point, because that's the only fix I see. Is it, you know, honestly, it's the worst thing ever is to go ahead and say that, hey, you have a price in something that is less than, you know, like a thousandth of a dollar. It's too messy and I can't count out that many zeros in my head. It's awful.
Yeah. So you got to take one side of it, eh? The commas or the sats?
Yeah.
It seems like we're going to go towards sats more and more as the price rises. But I guess to sum up your point there from earlier is that if you're a free markets person, like most Bitcoiners, I mean, all early Bitcoiners are free markets, like maximalists, like we're all libertarian types and stuff. And you should compete with Coinbase with Bitcoin only versus just complaining. So, I mean, I'm happy to see that there are some Bitcoin only companies just growing crazy, like Cash App and Swan Bitcoin and stuff like that. But Cash App's just really doing a good job of being a Bitcoin only company that doesn't allow you to gamble on altcoins. And just if you want to do that, you got to withdraw your Bitcoin or go somewhere else.
Right.
And it's great to see them succeeding with that. So maybe it's a better idea to elevate the good players than to try to complain about just the people that, you know, you perceive as the bad actors that actually have contributed positively. Like Coinbase has contributed positively. Cash App is probably the better thing to focus on now. Just like push people to that. Or holding their own keys.
Yeah, although to be fair, I would say that Coinbase offers something that the Cash App does not to end users. And one is that Coinbase has Coinbase and Coinbase Pro. Coinbase will charge you 200 basis points to go ahead and buy Bitcoin. So will Cash App. Coinbase Pro, if you do a little bit of effort, you can pay 20 basis points to buy Bitcoin.
So that's a basis point for people that don't know the word is like 200 is like 1% or 2% fee? Is that?
Last time I looked, it was probably about a 2% fee to go buy Bitcoin on the retail side of the And granted, a lot of people don't want to look at a V-shaped chart. They don't want to go ahead and figure out liquidity or trading or any of that stuff. And so for them, Coinbase or Cash App are perfect. But, you know, the fact that you can buy, if you just simply go to pro.coinbase.com, you don't open a new account, you just have to log in, you can go ahead and buy Bitcoin 10 times cheaper on Coinbase's Pro site. That is a service people want and should, you know, they should benefit from, especially if they're buying larger amounts. I don't think, you know, either Coinbase or Cash App for having their high fee, super easy to use ACH in type of transactions. I think that it makes sense. If the market wants to pay for it, the market wants to pay for it. But Coinbase does offer things that Cash App doesn't yet. And look, you know, the barriers to entry to create a US-based exchange are not zero, but it's also not something where you have to come up with $100 million worth of, you know, assets to go build an exchange. You can build an exchange for less than that. It probably costs you, let's call it a few million dollars worth of licensing and fees to go ahead and get up off the ground in all 50 states as a money services business. And so it's not something that, you know, is super, super high to go ahead and enter as a new exchange. And if you want to compete with Coinbase, you can. It's not like they have this big moat that nobody can go ahead and compete with them. They certainly have competitors in the US. And I would be upset if Coinbase was the only company. If they were like by far, if they had 95% of like the volume and the trading and it was very hard to have any other competitors, I think that'd be a problem. But the fact that there are so many other exchanges you can choose to go to, you know, I feel that is a market and that makes things, you know, pretty good for us as market participants.
Well, speaking of the market, like we didn't really talk much about the price. How are you feeling, man, about the run up?
Look, everybody has their doubts during the times when you look at the bear market and, the price has done things like 2019. 2019, that actually felt worse in some ways than the flush in 2018, because, all right, it was a bear market. You know, many of us were in denial all the way through May of 2018. You know, that, oh, no, it's fine. It's just a 20% dip, 50% dip. And no, no, it's really bad. You know, happened. And then 2019 happened with this fake. I run up to $14,000 and then it, you know, lasted for like a day. And then it pretty much ran away from us the rest of the year. And then obviously March was, you know, a disaster for most of the financial markets, and Bitcoin suffered it just the same as everything else. And I think that I had actually, you know, I tweeted it and said that, hey, look, if it wasn't by Q1 of this year, 2021, if we weren't seeing new all-time highs, I would be pretty disappointed. I'm not sure I'd be selling all my coins or something like that. And I don't think that would have been the case, but I definitely would have, you know, felt that, hey, look, something is not happening where the market is not appreciating what, you know, what Bitcoin is at that point. And so I would have been disappointed. And luckily, you know, we can feel good that wasn't the case. Most of us who have been in the space, like yourself and whatnot, have been in the space for 6 years. We've watched at least two full cycles play out. And at that point, you know, you kind of look at these markets and you see these big spikes and, you know, an 80% pullback, and you recognize that this is, you know, this is expected. This is normal. It doesn't mean it doesn't hurt when you miss the trade and you end up, you know, saying, oh, I wish I could have sold some at $1,200 in 2013 or at 15 grand plus in December 2017. But obviously it feels pretty good seeing all of these big investors willing to, you know, open up and talk about their, you know, their big positions in crypto at this point. That's probably the most surprising thing. The sheer number of institutional investors who came out of the woodworks in mid-December was insane. I would say that I wasn't expecting to have so many come along in such a short period of time.
Who was the most surprising one to you? Like, which one made you sit up and you read it and you're like, whoa, okay, this is going to happen now?
The most surprising was Michael Saylor, in the sense that, you know, you have this sleepy technology company that's been around for 20 years plus that all of a sudden, you know, positions itself with, you know, not just a small treasury, you know, reallocation, but really has become a company that is, their future is going to be heavily dependent upon what happens with Bitcoin, at least in the short term. So that's surprising for me as an insider. From the outsider, I think the number one was Paul Tudor Jones. He's somebody who people respect. He has a huge track record. And when he says, I'm putting in single-digit percentage of Bitcoin, it doesn't sound like somebody who drank the Kool-Aid. It sounds like somebody who did an analytical approach to Bitcoin and said that, look, I'd much rather have a piece of this than not. That rings true much more to many other high net worth family office or just even regular retail investors who would say, like, all right, I could buy 5% of Bitcoin. I could see that this is, you know, something where other smart people have done the diligence. They've checked this out. It's not a scam. You know, somehow Paul Tudor Jones figured out a way to tell that Bitcoin is real versus, like, you know, maybe he got faked out, bought the wrong thing. Like, if it's good enough for him, then I'm willing to go ride this too. That's probably the biggest deal of 2020.
And in terms of your, like, lessons learned and stuff over the last couple of cycles, I mean, I know because we're talk all the time about, like, our portfolio breakdowns and stuff, but are you willing to share that with people, or you kind of want to keep that private? I don't know how you think about your public image right now.
I don't hold anything that's actually too wild, so I, you know, I think that my portfolio is probably pretty ordinary.
I don't think so.
I mean, I would say so. It, for an insider, it's pretty normal. Number one asset is Bitcoin. I think that makes me fairly conservative for the DeFi crowd, many of which who either hold no Bitcoin whatsoever or have a small percentage of their assets. And then after that, it's ETH. I really feel that Bitcoin and ETH, Bitcoin is its own category, but at the same time, ETH has managed to go ahead and, I think, cement itself as a meme that just won't go away. And it doesn't matter if it won't scale perfectly now or it takes 5 years to get to, you know, proof of stake, it'll stick around. I don't think it'll go away in any capacity. And so those two are the, you know, biggest positions I hold. And after that, Polkadot is the next biggest position. It's an interesting product in the sense that if you take the view that there'll be many chains out there and that there'll be interoperability between these chains, the question is, how do you get that done? And for Polkadot, you say that, well, there's going to be one sort of source of truth chain that'll go ahead and determine the validity of all of the synchronizations between these various chains. And the way to do that is you have to buy DOT. You have to have, you know, the main chain decide, you know, what is that truth? And, you know, for the people who are really, really invested in Polkadot, you know, they make the argument that Polkadot can be bigger than anything else.
Do they really?
They do. And they can make some pretty cogent arguments about why that's the case. I think that's probably a long shot.
I've never paid attention to DOT at all. You know, obviously I've invested in a ton of different projects and stuff and got wrecked in 2018 and 2019 holding them all. What percentages, like, do you think you have in, I don't know if you want to get specific, but like, if someone's hearing you're saying you got Bitcoin and then your next biggest position is ETH, they may think you're like 50-50, you know, like, or 50-50, 149. No. Like, as a guy who was like early partner in Galaxy and SolidX partner and all that stuff, like, went big investor, you know, you invest in companies, you invest in coins, you invest in all kinds of stuff, nice haircuts and cars and stuff. What's your like asset class basket portfolio allocation?
I'm currently about 70% Bitcoin. I've been probably as low as 40% or so during like some of the altcoin cycles for like let's say 2017. But right now it's about 70%. And then ETH falls in next at about, let's call it 17%, give or take. And so everything else is smaller than that.
Have you recently like increased your ETH or lowered your ETH? Or like what's the last like 3 months of the Bitcoin bull run and ETH kind of picking up as well? Like what's that done to your thinking on your portfolio?
You know, for Bitcoin, I've done almost nothing. I took a little bit off in December, very small percentage, just to be sure that, hey, look, if at the end of December or early January that there's a big, you know, 20-30% pullback from, let's say, 19 grand, that, you know, that I'll be able to pay taxes and, you know, and be able to, you know, live my life without having to worry about, you know, what happens now with Bitcoin and have to sell more at prices I don't care for. The last time I actually bought Bitcoin in any significant amounts was actually on Coinbase, believe it or not. I don't think I bought it right around the crash, about $4,000, give or take.
Like in March?
In March, yeah.
Well timed.
Well, yeah, well timed. I wish I'd had more. I didn't have a good OTC desk at the time, but I should have done it because I would have, you know, bought a pile more at sub $5,000. Yeah, whatever, you know.
Man, I was tweeting like in March, I was tweeting a week before the COVID crash happened. I'm like, we're at $10,000. I see a 50% drop coming here. I'm going to sell and I'm going to buy back at 5,000. And, you know, I was talking like 5% or something like that, just a portion of from my speculation basket or whatever. I didn't want to be seeing my net worth drop 50% again. I wanted to hedge. And it happened so fast and recovered. I was caught, like, I did sell some and reduced my exposure. And I was planning on buying the dip because I thought it was going to happen and I missed it. Like I had an OTC desk relationship set up and everything. I had the money with them and I was just like, I slept through it or something. I just remember it dropped so fast to that 4,000s range where I wanted to buy. And then it just pumped back up again. And then I was just like, I'm not a good trader. I got to stop trying to time these things. Like I called it and I screwed up the trade.
You know, I think that's probably one of the hardest things to do. If I had to give any advice to people, it'd be, one, have patience and come up with a thesis and stick with it. Stick with it until something fundamentally changes. And if I had any one concern in, let's say, the first quarter of this year, it was correlation. I think a lot of us had it, is that, hey, look, why is Bitcoin so correlated to the financial markets? It is not the same as the S&P. And yet it moved so much in lockstep. It went ahead and plunged down with everything else. And that didn't feel good. But at the same time, like I went and looked at the price and I decided like, hey, look, this is not right. This is a moment to go ahead and buy. The only rule that tends to work in Bitcoin is that, hey, look, you know, if you buy massive, you know, declines, you know, in a market where it has been a bear market for quite some time, you know, you're going to do well. I did stick with that. Ethereum, I've held a position on and off. I did the original ICO. I probably hold exactly the same amount of Ethereum today in terms of units that I had back in 2015, I guess, when it issued. I've had zero at times. If I traded that better, I would be, you know, sitting on it. But, you know, I would be killing it because I had to buy back at much higher prices. And then Polkadot is one of those things where, look, you know, I don't have the strong core belief that I could just hold Polkadot and feel comfortable to sleep every night. I think that would not make me feel comfortable at all. I think on a risk adjusted basis, you know, Bitcoin is, and when I tell, you know, other non crypto people to go ahead and invest, I tell them that, look, they could do just fine with just buying Bitcoin, nothing else. And then the only thing they have to buy if they really decide they want to become more sophisticated in that is buy, you know, maybe a 5-to-1 or 10-to-1 ratio in value of Bitcoin to ETH. And that's it. They don't have to do anything else. They don't have to go ahead and go research every other asset on Coinbase. They don't have to trade. They just have to buy, let's call it, you know, some percentage of net worth that they feel comfortable that could, you know, plummet 80% and still be okay. And then just go find a hobby and go back to your life and go do something else.
Do you hold much cash, or are you kind of like, you think cash is toxic right now? Like, what's your thoughts there with cash and real estate and things like that?
You know, I think that's one of the tough things. I've been heavily in crypto. I don't have a ton of insight into everything else because I think I've spent so much time on focused on crypto over the last you know, professionally now 6 years, let's call it 7 years almost. I do look at, well, what happens at the cycle of what happens at $50,000 Bitcoin, $100,000 Bitcoin, $500,000 Bitcoin, you know, I think I'll hold Bitcoin and ETH and maybe a few other assets for the rest of my life in crypto. But I'd like to think that it probably won't be, you know, 80% of my exposure, and I'll be, you know, constantly in these, you know, cycles of blow off tops and bear cycles for the next, you know, 20 years or something like that. So there has to be some kind of a balance of other assets you hold. It feels like real estate, you know, is pretty solid. Real estate, art, I'm not an art fan, so I'd have to figure out how to pretend to be an art, you know, investor. And real estate, like I have a house, but, you know, that's not the same thing as being a real estate investor. So, you know, those things seem like they would hold, you know, value well and do well. And quite frankly, look, I understand that the PE ratio of the S&P 500 and particular certain assets like, you know, Tesla that just got recently added is insane. That said, I would not bet against the American economy, not over a long period of time. And, you know, it's one of the things you can take away from Warren Buffett. He's been right his entire life on not betting against the American economy. I don't think I would bet against the American economy for the next 25 years either.
But would you bet on it, though?
Yeah.
Like, are you in stocks?
I'm not now. I probably have like 2% of my net worth in stocks.
You wouldn't short it, but you won't go, like, you're not going to go, like, cash half your crypto in and buy stocks or something, right?
Not at these prices, no. I mean, look, I have a thesis on Bitcoin that's much, much stronger than my thesis on stocks. And so, you know, I'm going to stick with the things I know for now. Now, you know, you paint me a chart that looks like a champagne, you know, bottle that for the next 6 to 12 months. And will I hold a lot more stocks than, or maybe cash or real estate than I have today? Yeah, probably. I'd hope so. That would be the plan. But right now, on an opportunity basis, I don't have anything else. I think it's going to double or triple, you know, over the next 6 to 12 months.
What's your plan, Ivan? Are you thinking of like maybe doing more podcasts and stuff? Would you like to go on other people's podcasts? Or are you just doing this for me as a favor because we're friends?
I love the conversations. I don't get tired of talking about the space. I'm not sure that I have insights that are any better than anybody else's who's been around the space and had a chance to read a lot. But I enjoy it. So I do it for my own, you know, engagement and to go ahead and keep myself sharp. If I'm going to go ahead and debate somebody on a topic, or if I'm going to go ahead and try and educate somebody else, you know, I have to go ahead and refresh myself. I do it for my own personal interest. I'd enjoy it.
So if someone wants to get you on their podcast or their show or whatever, how do they get you? They just at iBrightly, is it?
At iBrightly is the best way to hit me on Twitter.
B-R-I-G-H-T-L-Y?
Just T-L-Y.
So how do you spell it? I-B-R-I-G-H-T-L-Y?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot for the chat, man.
All right, you got it. Thanks, Brad. Thanks for hosting me. You don't need to go so fast.